Hello and welcome back to the Golf News Vodcast series, Heart Matters, in association with King's College Hospital London in Dubai. I'm your host, Lachlan Kitchen, and throughout this series, we'll explore engaging and informative discussions all about the heart. And in this third episode of the series, we're going to aim to demystify heart procedures and tests and learn all about the latest technological advancements. It's going to be fascinating. So whether you're facing a procedure or you just want to understand your options, we'll break down everything in simple and relatable terms so that you are better informed. Joining me on this episode, episode 3, to explain it all, we are joined by Dr. Mahmoud Butt, the head of the cardiovascular department at the King's College Hospital London in Dubai. Dr. Butt carries nearly 25 years of experience in cardiac disease management while working at world-renowned hospitals such as John Radcliffe Hospital, Oxford, and the University Hospital Wales in Cardiff. Dr. Butt, I know you're a busy man, so thank you very much for your time here.
Thank you for having me.
We talk a lot about, you know, lifestyle and we talk about health issues, but for someone who perhaps doesn't present any symptoms, they're not suffering from shortness of breath, they don't have any of the pains, how important is regular cardiac screening for someone with no symptoms?
I think there's no fixed principles, there's no hard and fast rule as to when should you do this, but it's basically dependent on what your risk profile is. So for somebody who's a smoker or a diabetic or has high blood pressure, cholesterol issues, or somebody who's got a lot of members in their family have had a heart problem, I think they are on the risky profile. So perhaps it's sensible if, particularly in men, because they are more prone to have heart conditions compared with women. So I'd say 40 plus years old men who have one or more than one risk profile, even if they don't have a symptom, then perhaps it's not a bad idea to have themselves checked once in a while. Most of these tests are non-invasive and it gives you a very informed conclusion as to whether you do or you don't have a problem. If you're on the slippery slope, i.e. if you're developing a blockage, then there is something you can do if you detect it early. But if you develop symptoms, then as far as I'm concerned, you're already late.
So on that, what are some of those risk profiles that we should be aware of?
Some of the ones that we all know, such as smokers, they have a high tendency to have a heart problem. Diabetics, hypertensive, people with a high cholesterol, people with family history. Some are particularly interesting. For example, people with family history, they tend not to have a lot of symptoms. So by the time you find out one way or the other, you find that they have extensive problems. I recently treated a 39 years old guy who has got 6 blockages and not a single symptom.
Wow.
So, but on the other hand, there would be people, most of the people, the regular presenters, they, I'm a smoker for 20 years and started developing chest pain. So chest pain tends to develop when you already have 80, 90% blockage in one of your arteries. So it's, I think in modern day, we should identify the problem at a very early stage and we do have tools to do that.
Well, that showcases the importance of getting checked. And for someone who is maybe a little bit apprehensive, what does a comprehensive heart check involve today?
The most important part is actually having a consultation with a cardiologist and having a talk through, going through your profile. Many times with the experience, you know if somebody is at the risk, even if they don't have any symptoms. So then based on the patient's profile, you could do what we call a stress test, which is an ECG, a simple ECG that we attach some leads to your chest and you walk on the treadmill machine for about 10, 15 minutes. And when your heart is under a bit of a stress, if you have a problem, it will cry out for help in the form of chest pain or in the form of ECG changes. And in certain cases, when you have a higher suspicion, you could do a CT scan of the heart as well to find out if they do or don't have a problem. Another example, I met a lady only a couple of days ago and she was waiting for surgery. And I did her preoperative check and I found that her calcium score in her heart was 1400 when it should be zero. So there's a lot of calcium deposited in her heart. She didn't have any symptoms, but she does have two important 80, 90% blockages. So when you look at a patient in the consultation, you kind of get an idea what would be an appropriate test for them. But most of the time, it's a stress test or a CT scan.
Yeah. So on the issue of those stress tests, how exactly do they work? Because I know I've got a wearable device. There's an ECG on one of those. But how reliable are they at detecting a lot of those early signs of heart disease?
The ECG is quite an old test. the stress test historically was done in older people when they had symptoms, i.e. if somebody has pain when they walk or do an activity, then it's very conclusive. But in a regular person like yourself, for me, for example, in our age, you can walk with a blockage for about 12 minutes, 15 minutes without a single symptom. So it is not the most reliable test in a certain set of people, i.e. younger, healthier, sporty people. They need a lot more stress than our cutoff. So I'd say if you put an ECG on somebody, put them on the treadmill machine, there's been time when with the blockage, a person could walk for 15 minutes. But if you have a suspicion, a strong one, you should investigate it more.
One of the tools that's widely used now are CT angiograms, particularly in cardiac diagnosis. How would they compare, a CT angiogram, compared to some of the traditional methods in terms of accuracy, but also patient comfort?
I quite like CT scan, to be honest. The CT scan is a more modern way of detecting a problem at a way earlier stage than a stress test would. It's basically a modern X-ray of your heart, just zooming at your heart. And the only difference is that whilst you're zooming at the heart, taking pictures of it, you inject some dye, the color in the arm. It goes through the circulation, and when it hovers through the heart, the X-ray machine takes more pictures. And those pictures then with the softwares, you can make a whole video of that. It shows all three blood vessels, the major blood vessels, and the branches of them. And if there's any blockage, you could see it. If it's done properly, it is about 95% accurate, as opposed to a stress test, which is only 70-75% accurate.
Well, one of the things we're aiming to do is obviously breaking down a lot of terms so people are more aware and more informed. Two terms, angiography and angioplasty. People often get these confused. Talk me through the differences between the two and when you would use each one on a patient.
The angiogram is a gold standard as a final test. So once you've diagnosed a problem, or if somebody is coming through the emergency and you think they're having a heart attack, or you did a CT scan on a person and you found out that they have a blockage, then you do a test called angiogram.
Okay.
Angiogram or angiography, they're same terms really. It literally means taking pictures of your blood vessels of the heart. So angio means a blood vessel, and graphy means taking a picture. So what we do, we go under the local anesthesia on one of the days. Patients come in, we put a local anesthesia at the right wrist. Through that, we put a very fine tube all the way near the heart whilst the patient's talking to you as we are talking. And then I inject the dye from outside. The camera is mounted outside the patient. It takes pictures of the heart, and it takes about anything between 3 to 10 minutes to take all the pictures from different angles. This procedure is called angiogram. Now, this is 100% accurate as opposed to CT, which is 95, and the stress test, which is 70%. But you only do that when you really, really suspect that there's a problem. Now, once you found a problem on the angiogram, then you want to treat it if it is more than 70% blocked. Now, treating that, opening that blood vessel, changes the name of the procedure from angiography to angioplasty.
Okay, that's the difference. And if you're doing those tests, and you do unfortunately find some blocked arteries, how do you then decide between an angioplasty or a bypass surgery?
Mm-hmm.
And what are some of those influences that will decide that choice, whether it's the patient or their history or the level of each condition?
The patient's choice is important, but the scientific data is more important than that, to be honest. So there are certain scoring systems now that you put all the anatomical data that you get from the angiogram, i.e. how many blockages there, where are they, how important are they, how significant are they, is it 80% or 40%? You take all of those facts into account, along with some of the patient factors, i.e. diabetics or their high blood pressure, their family history, all of those factors. You put those scoring system, and scoring system then really divides into three major categories. Now, these are not the choices. These are the options that we give to the patients. End of the day, it's patient's heart and it's their choice. But then those three categories are number one, medicines. Number two, the stents, angioplasty. And number three is a bypass. So I would say if there are 100 patients, I would say in these days, maybe one or two patients would end up with a bypass, because now everything can be done through that keyhole that I was describing earlier, the angioplasty. And very few people are reserved for the medical treatment, because, you know, medical treatment is reserved for people when you can't do nothing. You can't do bypass or anything else. So I'd say 95% of the people, they will fall in that category where they need angioplasty. As I said, the 39-year-old guy treated with 6 blockages, all successful. Once you have suggested that to the patient that according to the data, they will do better in the longer term outcome, would be better with the bypass or stents, then many times it's patient's choice to say, you know what, I understand everything. I understand my longer term outcome is better, but I'm 82 years old. I don't want bypass. I want angioplasty. So it makes sense. So that's the patient's choice then vetoes anything, whatever that might be.
You talk about the technology. One of the things that we've discussed across this podcast series are obviously the latest developments. And it has been fascinating to hear what not is available in the future, but what's available now for patients. But can you maybe give us a bit of an insight in some of those new procedures or technology on the horizon that could, again, revolutionize heart disease treatment? Because one thing that came up I wanted to know a bit more about was shockwave therapy. What is that?
Shockwave really has revolutionized everything in terms of the coronary disease. So when you talk about the blockage, we talk about the cholesterol blockages. But then most of the time, these blockages have a lot of calcium on them. And when you have calcium, it is harder to treat. And those patients traditionally were reserved for bypass. But then at the same time, the patient's choice might not be to do that. And they want stents. And when you put stents in a patient with a lot of calcium, the longer-term outcome is not great. So the shockwave is one of the ways to break that calcium, remove that calcium. Historically speaking, we used to have microscopic drills. Now that sounds horrible, but you go through the same keyhole that I described earlier, through the same tubes, you go near a blockage. Imagine there's a collapsed tunnel. You go through the rubble, you literally drill through it, but that creates a lot of dust and debris. And the debris, along with the blood, goes somewhere else. So it was not a great solution, but for the last 20 years is what we're doing. The shockwave is basically through the same rubble, you put a balloon in there, and through that, you throw very strong sound waves. The patient doesn't feel anything.
The sound waves, the
amplifying effect of the sounds. You guys in media, so you understand the sound waves very well. So the sound waves basically in a confined space, they expand. And when they expand against a fixed material, i.e. calcium, it turns that into rubble. So it turns that into dust or very, very small pieces of that. So that shell of calcium, like the eggshell, that breaks into really small spots, and then you can easily treat.
How was that discovered that sound waves were going to be able to destroy all that calcium?
But most of the ideas, they come from simple observations. So if you look at the people in the mining industries, they have used a lot of explosions and they've used sometimes the sound waves. And if I mention a word lithotripsy, that will ring a bell that, oh, kidney stones are used to do that. Yeah. The kidney stones, calcium. Lithotripsy literally means sound waves. So you put the sound waves around at the stomach or at the back. You direct it like torch towards that stone under the ultrasound guidance. Goes in there, breaks into pieces, turns that into sand that comes through the urine. The same principle literally is used in the heart.
Unfortunately, it's not always, I guess, men in their 60s or 70s that come into your practice. Unfortunately, sometimes babies are born with small holes in the heart, which can, I can imagine, be incredibly traumatic for the family. But what are you doing when you work with those defects, and how has the approach within the medical fraternity changed over the years?
It is not that uncommon, actually, having holes in the heart, and they're not always small. I will be treating a guy who has 2-centimeter hole in his heart next week. So these holes are by birth. You can, most of the time there's no symptoms and you did an echo for a health check and you found you have a small hole or a large hole. The question is that when should you be thinking about closing it? If it's a really small one, it's not causing any enlargement of the heart and no symptoms, then you don't really want to bother. But if it is a moderate size, then the risk of stroke because of the mixing of good and bad blood is high, then you want to close it before it causes a stroke. Or if it is a really large one. Most of these holes can be closed again through the keyhole. You go through the leg. So imagine this room and the next room, between them, there's a wall. Now that wall has a hole. That's it. You come through a door in this room, you put a wire through that hole into the other end.
You make it sound far too simple.
It is simple, actually. The idea comes literally like that. So you throw a water, a wire or a rope through that hole into the other room, and then you anchor it back. There's a disc, a large disc, attached to that wire. You pull it literally as hard as you can against that wall, and once it is there, it gets jammed. You detach the wire, you come out, takes 25 minutes.
Done. 25 minutes for that surgery. Must be a lot of relief.
30 minutes, let's say.
30 minutes, okay. let's be conservative. One of the things we've been hearing a lot about is the TAVI, the TAVI or the TAVR. They're alternatives to some of those traditional value surgery. Mm. I know whenever you hear alternatives, sometimes there's a bit of skepticism within the medical fraternity, but can you maybe explain what they are and who might benefit from these?
TAVI stands for a transaortic transfemoral aortic valve replacement. So as I was saying earlier, there are three blood vessels around the heart, but they're outside. They're like plumbing in a room. As opposed to that, there are four valves within the heart, and they are the doors between the two different rooms, literally. So they guide the air and flow of the blood between these two rooms. So these doors are called valves. One of the valves is called aortic valve, and that's a door between the heart and all the oxygen that goes through the body. Everything that goes through to your body is going through that door. Now, if sometime people are born with a defective valve that gets narrowed, sometime is a wear and tear with the age, and generally about 50, 60, 70 years, the valve's worn out. And when it worns out, then it kind of gets thicker and harder to open. So you get like fish mouth. So it gets narrowed and narrowed and narrowed. So lesser blood is going out to your body. You start feeling tired, fatigued, less energy, breathlessness, chest pain. Sometimes even people faint. And if you do a simple screening echo, which is an ultrasound of the heart, you can simply diagnose it. If that narrowing is really bad in the severe category, then you have to open it. Now, traditionally speaking, it's an open heart surgery. So open heart surgery means you open somebody's chest, you remove the old door, put a new one in, stitch it up, close the chest, and yeah, you go, that's it. But 25 years ago, a Frenchman then, he found out that the idea would be that why not squish the door and put a new one on top of that? And that's literally what TAVI is. So you go in with a keyhole from the leg, you go in there, you go next to the door, you mount a new door. Behind that door, the older one is squished. Using the word door, but actually the new valve squishes the old one. And once a new one is inflated, it starts working immediately. Now, current guidelines suggest that anyone who's 75 years plus, this is the first line treatment for them. So you don't need open heart surgery. And that's why I was saying earlier, is that the bypass surgery is getting thinner and thinner in terms of its scope, although there are still patients who need it. But generally speaking now, the arteries work, the valve work, the muscle work, everything can be done through a keyhole.
So does that then obviously becomes a more attractive option given a patient in their, perhaps, as you said, mid-70s, that if they're not having surgery, the recovery time is lessened as well?
Yeah, true. The patient goes home the next day.
The next day.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Well,
it is.
We've often spoken about the modern lifestyle. We're sitting more at desks more than our parents or our grandparents ever did. Life tends to be a bit more stressful than it's ever been. What changes do you recommend for people to protect their heart health? And how have you seen patients perhaps change their approach towards preventative treatments?
I'm really happy that you asked this question, actually. The modern life comes with a lot of stress. And honestly speaking, in the 25 years, I would say in the more recently, I would say 5 to 10 years time, the amount of stress, the anxiety that I've seen in walking into the clinic is mind-boggling.
Do you have a reason why that is?
I think after COVID and after COVID vaccines, there's a lot of heart problems that are coming to surface now, particularly younger people. There's a lot more in social media, and that creates anxiety. We live in a very competitive world. Most of us are threatened for jobs and businesses and all that. So there's a compounding effect of the personal, the social, professional, and then on top of that, the medical health anxiety, all of them putting together, it can't you really push it down. Then on top of that, in my personal practice, I don't quite like when people take the protein supplements and whey proteins and all that, because I've seen they end up with palpitations, sometimes heart attacks even. There's no scientific safety data on that, but people taking scoopfuls of them, glasses full of them every day.
I had one this morning, now I feel bad.
I'm not saying that this is absolutely wrong, but it's my personal experience. I see some connections.
Real food, go back to real foods.
I agree with that. And I'd say going back to basics, where I believe water is the best fluid. Going back to basics means organic vegetable, fruits, less animal products, more walking, whatever you can do. In the heart of heart, we all know what's right, what's wrong. I don't necessarily recommend man-made products. So I'd say whatever's nature, it's better for the heart.
I think you're exactly right. And it is important to stress, deep down, we all know what we should and what we shouldn't be doing. Over the last couple of years, patient outcomes have certainly improved with the adoption of so many new techniques. What do you think patients can expect today compared to the past in terms of post-surgery, recovery, and also times upon which, how long they can expect the success of the surgery to work within their body?
Would you believe it if I tell you?
Well, yeah, please.
So 1970s, for example, for the comparison, the 1970s, the treatment for heart attack was bed rest. If you make it, you make it. You don't make it, you don't make it. You either end up dying or you have massive complications. But now, for example, 3 days ago, I treated a guy with a heart attack, came middle of the night with a crushing chest pain, had a totally blocked artery, and a second blood vessel was 80% blocked. We opened both of them. It took 45 minutes. 24 hours later, patient's gone home.
45 minutes.
45 minutes later, he was in CCU. He stayed in the hospital for 24 hours. And then you go home. You just got to take medicine, have a regular doctor follow-up visits, and that's about it.
So he's not then put on.
Perfectly normal. The important thing to stress is the coming in time. If you sit on a chest pain, which happened to be coming from your heart, and if your artery is blocked for more than 24 hours and you just waited and waited and waited because you thought it was a stomach pain, the artery is dead then. Even if you open it, there's no point opening it. The damage is done. Damage is permanent. The sooner you come, the better. As we say, muscles are minutes. So the sooner you come, the better.
For someone who is perhaps in an unfortunate position where they're facing some of these procedures, that can be a stressful time. What questions should they ask their cardiologist so they can fully understand the treatment options and what would work best for their situation?
The standard question the patient normally asks is about the procedure. So the procedure, we can show them on a large mounted TV or on our computer screens. We go through all the steps. Then they would ask about the risks, the pros and cons of the procedures. Before this podcast, I literally spoke to a guy that I treated yesterday, and they asked questions, can I go back to work after this? When can I start exercising? They can ask as many questions as they want, frankly. But I would also want to say that in 20 minutes or 30 minutes, you're not going to turn a patient to cardiologist. There will always be questions popping in your mind when you're at home and you don't have a cardiologist on your phone number. Let's say that you should be able to trust your doctors, to be honest. So I'd say you go to a cardiologist, you ask as many and as silly question as you think it can be, but they should be able to answer you. And once you're comfortable with that, in this day and age, it's a very safe procedure. If you're going for a procedure, it's not an unfortunate thing, to be honest, because it's better to find a problem before the problem finds you. So if you find a problem, you fix it, all you have to do is to take some medicines for the rest of your life, and that's about it.
What a great line. It's better to find a problem before the problem finds you.
Yeah.
And does that come through part of the stress? Because do most people come in concerned that heart means life and therefore they feel a lot more anxiety towards a procedure like this?
Part of that is everyone is scared for their life, but at the same time, there is a very strong temptation in everyone, all of us, that we don't want to take medicine. But this is life. We also have a human side of us. So you say that, if you are becoming diabetic, you can live in an imaginary world, say, I don't have diabetes, I'm not going to take medicine. Or be a regular, healthy person, think, okay, it's unfortunate, there's anything that I can do about it, I'll do it. But then if end of the day I have to take medicine, I have to take medicine. I can tell you stories after stories of the people who the cholesterol levels are literally 1,000, literally don't want to take medicine. Now, what do you expect in future?
But why wouldn't they want to take the medicine? Because surely that's one of the best advancements.
Well, one of the reasons why they won't want to take medicines that they say is because, and by the way, I'm not a salesman for medicine,
okay,
but I'm just saying that when it's necessary, you should take it, is because it reduces the risk and the data supports that. So the reason why they don't want to take it is one of the reasons is a social thing, the social dilemma. This is associated with people saying, you take medicine, you're weak. Deep down, you know, psychologically speaking, that exists. I don't take paracetamol if I have headache. A lot of people say that. Why not? Just, you know, don't have to put up with a headache. The other thing is that they're scared of the side effects. And third commonest reasons that no one explained to them in details as to what are the pros and cons of not taking the medicines and how would it change their longer term outcome.
Looking ahead to the future, every sector is being influenced by artificial intelligence, if they haven't already. What do you see the role within AI and a lot of the new technologies in interpreting stress tests and ECG readings? And if you can look into that crystal ball, how do you see the future of cardiology procedures evolving over the next 10 to 20 years? What are you excited about?
There is a crystal ball, actually. It's called retinal screening, for example. One of the AI tools is that this is a very simple machine, for example. We don't use it at the moment, but some of the places they do. So it's a screening test. You literally screen somebody's retina. It's like if you go to the optician, they check your eyesight. So you have to put your eye like this. And then it takes pictures of the back of your eye, see the state of the arteries. And there is some relationship between the state of those arteries and the state of the arteries of the heart. So without going anywhere near the heart, just by screening the eye, you can have an idea. For example, doing an analysis of your pulse at the wrist, you can have some idea about what is the state of the heart as well. So there's a lot of exciting tools coming up, but whether they are validated fully or not, that is yet a question to be answered. It's very exciting times ahead of us, really. And with the robotic surgery, robotic angioplasty, where I don't do it, a robot does it. I just command it to do that. So,
yeah, we touched on that on the last episode as well. And obviously, the future of smart devices and smartwatches for constant monitoring that might be able to send information back to a physician seems fascinating.
It is fascinating. I don't think people should be scared of heart conditions, to be honest. I'm very proud to say that is one of those very heavily researched area of medicine. Everything is black and white. So it's a fortunate thing that something can be done. So if somebody had a heart attack and they are told that you will live a perfectly normal life in terms of quantity and quality, except they would take a couple more medicines and that's about it. I mean, it's not to loss, is it?
Well, Dr. Mahmoud Butt, this has been another fascinating chat. Again, I'm going to take that line, find the problem before the problem finds you. I think that is great.
All yours.
For all factors of medicine. It's been great to learn from you and also from your experience. Thank you very much for your time on
You're
Heart
welcome.
Matters.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, my thanks once again to Dr. Mahmoud Butt for being our guest on this episode of the Golf News vodcast series, Heart Matters. If you'd like to learn more about heart health or to find out more about any of the episodes in this series, then please visit our website, golfnews.com/podcasts/heart-matters. And don't forget to click and subscribe so that you never miss a future episode of Heart Matters. I'm Lachlan Kitchen. Thank you very much for joining us. And I look forward to your company on the next episode of the Golf News vodcast series, Heart Matters.